From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, a journey to the heart of the Keystone Pipeline controversy. Gas prices are up, and some critics of the president say it's in part because he rejected the Keystone XL pipeline.
We should have moved forward with the project. And all he has to do is decide, is it in the national interest or not?
We'll hear stories from different sides of that battle, politicians, oil men, and the cattle ranchers who fought him.
Didn't think there was any way in hell that a foreign corporation could just come in here and take our land away from us if we didn't want them to.
Plus, the ghosts who walk the halls of the State Department, employees who can't be fired but have to show up anyway, and a day in the life of former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
He has the makeup on. He was wearing like a dark blue cashmere jogging suit.
And later, why young jazz master Robert Glasper wants to shake up the jazz establishment.
Ha! You're rocking. Yes, you are rocking with the fresh. You are rocking with the depth. You are rocking with the best. You are rocking with the yes.
And you won't want to miss this one, how the Cranberries changed the life of one young man. We'll have a special cameo appearance right here in the studio. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Here's a question. Why is the price of gas all of a sudden going up? At this gas station here in Washington, D.C., a gallon of regular unleaded is $3.86. That's 12% higher than this time last year. And there's a pretty good chance that soon it'll reach an average of $4 a gallon nationally. But why now? Demand is at the lowest in over a decade, and domestic oil production is at an 8-year high. Well, some analysts attribute the higher prices to tension with Iran. Others point to speculators on Wall Street. And then there are those who say it's all about President Obama's policies. In particular, a decision the president took late last month to deny a permit for a massive oil pipeline. It's called Keystone XL. It's a pipeline that would travel more than 2,000 miles from one of the biggest oil deposits in the world in Alberta, Canada, all the way down to the Gulf Coast. Today and tomorrow on the program, we're going to take a closer look at Keystone XL, the plan, the controversy, and the potential consequences if that pipeline is or is not built. Keystone XL, the North American oil boom, and what it means for gas prices, that's our cover story. Now, the first thing you need to know about the Keystone pipeline, it already exists.
Put your hand on it.
Yeah, you can feel it going through there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that's all coming all the way from Canada.
Yes, it is.
This is the sound of Canadian heavy crude oil. For more than a year, it's been flowing south down the Keystone Pipeline from the Canadian tar sands in Alberta. It ends in Oklahoma in the small town of Cushing, population 7,000. And there, the oil is stored in massive tanks, hundreds of tanks scattered all across the town. Now, the pipeline that doesn't exist, the one you've heard all the debate about, is a second proposed pipeline. That's Keystone XL. It would be bigger than this pipeline, and it would follow a more direct route from Canada. The same company that built the first one wants to build the second. It's a company based in Calgary called TransCanada. Virgil Fenig is TransCanada's manager in Cushing, Oklahoma, and he showed us around last week.
So 500,000 barrels of oil a day or more can come through here.
Yes, that is correct.
Canada has the potential to produce more than 6 times the amount of oil it now makes. But because the existing pipeline ends in Oklahoma, Canada has no way to deliver its oil to refineries on the Gulf Coast and from there to the lucrative global oil market. That's what Keystone XL was supposed to resolve. And with one Keystone pipeline already pumping at full capacity, the second one wasn't supposed to be particularly controversial. But the project hit a snag, some 420 miles north of Cushing in the State House in Lincoln, Nebraska. TransCanada originally proposed running the XL pipeline through the sand hills of northern Nebraska. It's one of the most delicate ecosystems in the country, right above the massive Ogallala Aquifer. And that's where TransCanada ran into a ragtag coalition of environmentalists, cattle ranchers, Republicans, and Democrats who stood in the way.
Test 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Producer Brent Bachman and I traveled to Oklahoma and to Nebraska last week to find out more. Our first stop was to the office of the governor, Dave Heineman, a Republican.
And what do you recommend we eat in Nebraska?
You should go to a steakhouse.
Beef.
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
I had beef for lunch.
I'd have beef for dinner, too.
Nebraska is the third largest cattle state in the country. And a few years ago, it was small-scale cattle ranchers who began to raise concerns over the route of Keystone XL. Now, all pipelines, even the most advanced, like TransCanada's, eventually leak. And cattle ranchers feared that a leak along the Keystone XL pipeline could devastate the Ogallala Aquifer. It's one of the largest aquifers in America and a primary water source for farmers and ranchers in seven states who raise cattle, wheat, and corn. Governor Heineman sided with the ranchers in the Sandhills. So last August, he wrote a letter to President Obama asking him to deny TransCanada a permit to build Keystone XL.
When I wrote that letter, we were trying to get their attention to say, look, we don't want it to go through the Sandhills. And probably the only option at that time was to deny the permit if we had to go that far.
Heineman now says President Obama should have approved the pipeline, but conditionally, the condition that it wouldn't run through the Sandhills.
When you've got an 8.3% unemployment rate in America and we're trying to have energy independence, to me, this was a no-brainer. We should have moved forward with the project. And all he has to do is decide, is it in the national interest or not?
Now, supporters of the pipeline argue more oil from Canada means the U.S. would rely less on oil from places like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. And TransCanada says the pipeline will create 20,000 direct jobs and thousands more related ones. Those figures are disputed by opponents. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. But what the company didn't expect was a man named Randy Thompson, now the most famous rancher in Nebraska.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to Nebraska.
Thank you. Thank you. We're delighted to be here.
Randy Thompson is a barrel-chested rancher who wears a white cowboy hat. He stuffed some tobacco inside his lower lip and showed us around.
Here's one of my old longhorns right here. That's the one we butchered.
A bone-white longhorn skull is mounted on the barn door.
See what shot her in the head. Hell of a way to treat your pets, isn't it?
4 years ago, Thompson was contacted by an agency representing TransCanada.
I just got a call one day out of clear blue sky.
And that call?
He just said, well, there's a pipeline proposed, and it would possibly come across your land, and wondering if we could have permission to come on and do some surveying.
TransCanada wanted Thompson and all affected landowners to sign over the rights to part of their land in order to build the pipeline. Randy Thompson was offered $9,000, but he wasn't interested, so the company started to get aggressive. And in 2010, TransCanada sent a letter to his mother, who co-owned that land with him.
At the time, my mom was 92 years old, and she got this letter. You know, it says, you are by now aware that TransCanada Keystone Pipeline is constructing and will operate an 1,833-mile crude oil pipeline.
The letter goes on to read that if he refused to cooperate,
Keystone will use eminent domain to acquire the easement.
His first call was to his lawyer. The lawyer's advice? Cooperate. Eminent domain was nothing to mess around with, and if TransCanada was successful, Randy Thompson would receive less than favorable terms.
I got to tell you, I was sick when I got this letter. It keeps you up at night. And I've talked to a lot of landowners. Now, we're not used to dealing with this kind of stuff.
There are questions as to whether TransCanada even had the power to threaten eminent domain at the time. The letter suggests the pipeline project had been approved. Thompson was stunned that a foreign company could potentially take over his land. A TransCanada official, Robert Jones, says the company was simply following normal procedure.
The Keystone Pipeline system was under construction in 2010. We were absolutely considering the precedent in the past, anticipating a presidential permit. Shortly.
What bothered Thompson and other cattle ranchers in Nebraska was the tone of the letter. He felt it was unnecessarily aggressive, but in fact, similar letters sent to other landowners had the opposite effect.
I had a neighbor told me, he said, these guys are way too big. He said, there's no need to fight them. He said, we just will sign it and get it over with. So he signed the easement right away.
Right in the heart of the Sandhills, about 4 hours northwest of Lincoln, Sue Luby, another cattle rancher, is getting ready for calving season. The water table on her land is so close to the surface, you only need to dig down 2 feet to hit the Ogallala Aquifer.
So, yeah, how does this work?
She has more than 40 water windmills on the ranch that pull the water into troughs for the cows to drink from. One afternoon 4 years ago, Sue Luby noticed an unusual sight in this part of Nebraska, a low-flying helicopter hovering over her land. Inside the cockpit, two surveyors working on behalf of TransCanada. The chopper terrified Luby's cattle and caused a stampede that sent them into a barbed wire fence, leaving some of the cows bloodied.
I got on the hood of my pickup and I pointed a rifle at them.
And they saw that?
Oh, yeah. I also gave them some sign language. They kind of understood, so they took off straight to the east as fast as they could go.
Sue Luby refused an offer of $18,000 to allow TransCanada to build the pipeline on her land. And like Randy Thompson, she got hooked up with a liberal group called Bold Nebraska, a group that made it its mission to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, so essentially, this is Bold Nebraska's office.
From the upper floor of a small building in downtown Lincoln, Jane Klebb heads up Bold Nebraska.
I think for some of us, you know, early on, maybe it was we were opposed to it through the San Jose of the Aquifer. But as we've seen TransCanada's behavior to landowners, we don't trust them.
So for now, Randy Thompson, Sue Luby, and other opponents of Keystone XL have won. TransCanada now says it will submit a new proposal to the U.S. government next year, a route, the company says, that won't go through the Sandhills. There was a time when that might have been good enough, but now Randy Thompson and other ranchers like him are convinced that the whole enterprise is bad for the environment and a raw deal for Nebraska. And he's become a symbol in the state. There are signs all across Nebraska that feature his face. They read simply, "I stand with Randy."
My parents didn't raise me to lay down and roll over for people. I mean, my folks got married in 1933, and they didn't raise a crop for 7 years in a row. They went through the drought, the depression, and they survived all that. And they were like in their 50s before they were ever able to buy a piece of land. And I'll tell you right now, that's what drives me, because I know what my folks went through to get a piece of ground. And these sons of come along and they tell me, "We're going to take this land away from you, whether you want us to or not." And they got a fight on their hands.
Back in the state capital, Lincoln, Governor Heineman told us he's sympathetic, but only to a point.
And the fact of the matter is, we're still going to be using coal and oil for a long period of time. Hey, I'm a supporter that we need cleaner coal technology and those things, but it is not going to happen overnight. And in the meantime, I'd like to keep energy costs low for our citizens.
But how much of an impact will more Canadian oil flowing into the U.S. have on oil prices? And what about the environmental consequences?
Well, let's be clear. If Canada can't produce this oil, we'll have higher oil prices than we otherwise would.
That's Michael Levy. He's an energy analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations. Late last month, President Obama rejected a plan by the Calgary-based company TransCanada to build Keystone XL. It's a pipeline that would cross seven states and transport up to 700,000 barrels of Canadian oil a day to refineries on the Gulf Coast.
The Keystone XL pipeline helps make sure that this resource can be developed if it's economically needed. And so that's good for the U.S. economy.
Now, the president doesn't necessarily oppose the pipeline, but he denied TransCanada the permit to build it because he argued there wasn't enough time to study its environmental impact. So for now, the company plans to file a new proposal next year. Now, to fully understand the impact of Keystone XL, you have to visit the small town of Cushing, Oklahoma, known locally as the pipeline crossroads of the world. Producer Brent Bachman and I traveled from Nebraska through Kansas and on to Cushing last week to learn more about the pipeline.
Yeah, that's an oil smell.
The first thing you notice in Cushing is the smell, something like a combination of burning rubber, asphalt, and a gasoline station.
Smells like money.
That's Brett Anderson. He was born and raised in Cushing. He's a small-time oil man and something of an amateur local historian here who gave us a personal tour.
When I was a kid growing up, our last refinery.
Eventually, we pulled up to the highest point in Cushing, overlooking the entire town.
So where are we right now, Brett?
Well, we're just north and west of the airport, and basically all the tanks were all south and east of here.
It's an overwhelming sight. Giant white oil tanks that stretch for miles across Cushing's red soil landscape. Many of America's pipelines meet up and terminate right here, and it's why so much oil gets stored here. We drove around with Brett for an hour, and we still didn't see all the tanks. And though we looked, it's hard to find anyone in Cushing opposed to building pipelines or extracting oil.
All these ecologists and the green people, they want to have their cars and be able to fly places. It's the way the world is now.
Cushing just might be one of those rare places in America where the economic recession seems to have passed. Business is booming.
Do you want to take us in first? Or
sure.
Okay.
It's so good that Pete Schwering, the chief operating officer of an oil storage company called Rose Rock Midstream, is adding 5 new tanks on his tank farm.
Careful, there's a little water.
Schwering took us inside a brand new and still empty tank, capable of storing 250,000 barrels of oil.
So this is the inside.
This is the roof of the tank right here.
And this tank farm alone, soon it'll be capable of storing 2 million barrels a day, or about 10% of all the oil consumed in America in a single day.
I've been in this business 42 years, and I've never seen activity out there on the production side like what's happening right now in northern Oklahoma, western Oklahoma.
There is so much oil coming into Cushing that there's actually a glut.
In Ohio, Pennsylvania.
These are good times.
Yeah. It's going to be coming in.
A glut that's translated into big business for the storage companies. But what might be good for people like Pete Schwering is bad for pipeline companies like TransCanada, companies that can't send that oil out of Cushing and onto the Gulf of Mexico, North America's gateway to the global oil market. In Cushing, there are lots of incoming pipelines, but not enough outgoing ones. Some of the oil moves to refineries in the Midwest, where it's turned into gasoline, but it's not happening fast enough. So in Cushing, there's a bottleneck. This sound?
You're hearing the crude oil flowing through the pipeline.
This is the TransCanada Keystone Pipeline. Yeah, it starts in Alberta, Canada. It travels almost 2,000 miles and ends right here in Cushing. Virgil Fennig is the terminal manager for TransCanada in Cushing, and he showed us around.
Just continuing through. This is just one of our valves that we have in the system.
This pipeline was completed last year. The problem is it can only handle 500,000 barrels of oil a day that flow from the tar sands in Alberta, Canada. Those tar sands now make up the second largest proven oil reserve in the world. And Canada wants to send more than twice that amount down to the Gulf Coast refineries, where it can potentially be traded on the lucrative global oil market. But in order to do that, TransCanada wants to build a second pipeline, the one President Obama rejected last month, the one known as Keystone XL. TransCanada's argument for building it is twofold. One, it'll create 13,000 direct jobs, they say, a figure disputed by other independent analysts. The other selling point? Here's Robert Jones, a top executive with the company.
When you look at the premise of the project and why the project was created, which is to serve the public and the public interest, it is so that the U.S. is less dependent on foreign sources of oil, such as those from Venezuela or OPEC.
It sounds like a compelling argument. If only the U.S. could buy more oil from Canada, it wouldn't have to buy as much from potentially unstable countries in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. But there's a problem with that argument. TransCanada is a pipeline company. It's not an oil company. The oil that flows through its pipes is owned by oil companies. And there's no guarantee that once refined on the Gulf Coast, that oil would stay in the United States. If oil companies can make more money selling it overseas, well, that's the business of oil. And then there's the problem of Canadian crude oil. It's heavy. At one of the biggest oil storage companies in Cushing, Plains All American, we met Tim Wary, the terminal manager.
These are the samples that they were talking about.
He proudly showed off a display of 96 small vials.
This is not aromatherapy. This is oil, right?
That's oil.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. Vials filled with different types of crude oil that have passed through this tank farm.
A lot of people really don't understand what you're talking about when you talk about crude oil. They think it's just one thing and that's it. Well,
there's oil from Brazil, Canada, Africa, Russia, Angola. Wow, look how thick that is, that Mexican oil. That's like molasses.
Yeah, very, very heavy, very viscous. I mean, it's really comparable to what you'll see come out of Canada.
The difference between Canadian tar sands oil and, say, Oklahoma light sweet crude is like the difference between Coca-Cola and cake batter. To send Canadian oil thousands of miles south to Cushing, you have to mix it with lots of chemicals to thin it out.
and they won't tell us what's in the oil to make it flow. I mean, they dilute it with some kind of chemicals.
That's Randy Thompson, a Nebraska cattle rancher we heard from in our story yesterday. He successfully spearheaded a campaign to halt the construction of Keystone XL through the ecologically sensitive sandhills of Nebraska that lie atop one of America's largest underground aquifers.
And we know they're toxic chemicals. A lot of us people out here, you know, we got to drink this water, and it'd be nice to know what the hell they're pumping through it.
TransCanada claims that its proposed Keystone XL line will be the safest of its kind ever built. Here's TransCanada executive Robert Jones again.
I believe that we can absolutely build pipelines with new technology that are getting closer and closer to being leak-free. And compared to moving oil by rail car or by barge or by truck, it is 50 to 100 times safer.
But the heart of the debate, at least for many environmental activists like those at this anti-pipeline demonstration in Washington late last year, isn't just about the Keystone XL pipeline. It's really about the source of the oil it would carry. Last year, a NASA scientist, James Hansen, wrote that if the Alberta tar sands continue to be mined for oil, it's, quote, game over for the climate. Now, in order to get crude oil from those tar sands, you have to heat it up. And scientists estimate that process produces up to 80% more atmospheric carbon than traditional drilling in places like Saudi Arabia and Oklahoma.
Keystone XL will be by far the biggest push in terms of plumbing those tar sands, building the infrastructure required to fully exploit them.
That's Bill McKibben, a longtime environmental activist. He led that demonstration last November when thousands of anti-XL protesters surrounded the White House. McKibben and other opponents of Keystone XL believe that if they can prevent its construction, it could dramatically slow down the mining at the Canadian tar sands.
Sooner or later, hopefully sooner, we have to actually start getting off fossil fuel. This is a very good place to start. We need to keep carbon out of the atmosphere. This oil, like all the other kind of unconventional oil, needs to stay in the ground.
All of the arguments raised by opponents and by proponents are based on two different sets of facts. Lots of jobs versus a few, lower gas prices versus higher ones, and environmental catastrophe versus the realities of human consumption. What is clear, though, is that both sides are determined to win. Americans burn through 18 million barrels of oil a day, so the stakes are high. TransCanada stands to make billions. Environmental activists believe the pipeline will set back the development of renewable energy. And the battle for and against Keystone XL is very far from over. The halls of the State Department are haunted, not by actual ghosts, but by people who might as well be ghosts. They're called hallwalkers, people who blew the whistle, people who angered someone powerful, people who, for one reason or another, can't be fired. But they can be stripped of their security clearances, their desks, and their duties, and left to walk aimlessly up and down the halls of that massive building. Sometimes they're required to show up at the building to get paid. Sometimes they're allowed to telecommute from home. And after 23 years in the Foreign Service, Peter Van Buren joined their ranks last fall when he published a scathing account of his year working on what he believed were wasteful reconstruction projects in Iraq, like a multi-million dollar chicken processing plant that never really got off the ground.
The problem came when General Odierno's blogger friend decided she wanted to see the chicken plant. I don't know how she heard about it. Maybe she saw it on a list. And we were stuck with having chickens in the plant the day she arrived. The word got around very quickly that the Americans were buying chickens for cash, and the price went up probably 100% that afternoon. We got 50 or 60 chickens. We ran them through the plant when she was there.
Wait, you did this, you almost staged this for Odierno's, somebody who was writing a blog for General Odierno.
We came to call it the Potemkin Chicken Plant, remembering back to the early days in Russia where the money was squandered, and so they built a stage set to impress the empress. With future visitors, we evolved a sliding scale of chickens, depending on the relative importance. If you were a big shot reporter from a television network, you'd see 50 or 60 chickens slaughtered for your pleasure. If you were a print journalist from a known newspaper, 10 or 20. With respect from NPR, maybe 4 or 5 chickens.
Peter, with all due respect, I mean, sorry, just to get serious for a moment, I mean, that's fraud. Why were you doing that? That wasn't part of your mandate. You were the head of a provincial reconstruction team. Why didn't you just be honest and say, when people came, say, listen, this is a project that just doesn't seem to be working?
Honesty was one of the few things we had in short supply in Iraq. From Washington through the embassy, including the army, there was an incessant demand for success. We were under extraordinary pressure to show that the State Department was succeeding in reconstruction in Iraq where other organizations had failed previously.
Why did you decide to write about it later on?
By the time I was finished, the overwhelming sense that I had participated in this caught me and made me realize that the story that people were hearing back home was not the story of what we were doing there on the ground. And I realized that this was a story that probably needed to be told, particularly as I watched the program in Iraq be folded up, packed up, and shipped off to Afghanistan, where, in fact, the same process is going on right now. We needed to learn from that lesson, and so I wrote this book.
Did you have authorization to write the book?
Absolutely. The State Department requires all of us to submit our writing in advance, a 30-day suspension period, while they review it.
Since then, since its publication last fall, you say the State Department has retaliated against you. They have taken away, for example, your security clearance. What else has happened since?
The State Department, when I came back from Iraq, gave me a position that was consummate with my experience. I was assigned to the Board of Examiners to help choose the next generation of Foreign Service officers. Unfortunately, through a trumped-up charge that a link on my blog was considered a security violation, I lost my security clearance. That caused the State Department to then proclaim that my judgment in my job selecting new Foreign Service officers was in question, and I was kicked out of that job when a particularly offensive blog post caught their attention in late October, Hillary Clinton chortling over the death of Muammar Gaddafi. I was told that I was no longer wanted, and I was sent home. I was told in writing that I was banned from any State Department facility. I could not access the computer network. I had no job tasks in front of me. They couldn't figure out a way to stop paying me. And so I sat home for 8 weeks at full salary doing nothing.
Well, here's a question. I mean, if you, let's say, violated the State Department's policies or you did something they didn't like or they felt that you had exercised poor judgment as they claimed, why couldn't they fire you?
There are procedures in the State Department to fire someone or to discipline someone. There are rules that the State Department claims I've broken. But rather than pursue those avenues, which would have allowed me to defend myself, the State Department instead followed a different path where they used bureaucratic tools, unofficial ways of doing business that pushed me out of the village, sent me into the wilderness.
Wait, so let me just get this straight, Peter. You are an active member of, you are an active employee of the State Department.
That's correct.
Right now. But you don't go there every day.
I am not allowed to go there every day. I fought a 8-week battle with the State Department to get my entry badge back. I'm currently assigned as a teleworker, largely without portfolio.
And you are paid the salary of somebody who's been there for 20
years. The same salary that I've earned for my years of experience. That's correct.
Was it worth it? Was it worth, all you've been through and now you're about to end your career?
It's a very difficult question to answer and one that, to be honest, I've thought about quite a bit. However, when I go home and turn on the news and listen to the Secretary of State claiming that the rights of bloggers in China need to be respected, that journalists in Syria have a right to speak back to their government, that people in Vietnam who use Twitter and freedom fighters around the world who want to organize through Facebook all have rights to these things, that the internet is a force for good and freedom. And at the same time, the same Secretary of State's organization is seeking to oust me, to destroy me, to push me out of it. I realize that that level of hypocrisy needs to be answered. And I find that, yes, it is worth it. It was worth it, and it will be worth it to answer that level of hypocrisy and demand from that Secretary of State, Madam, why is your institution not allowing me the same rights that you're bleating about for bloggers around the world? Why not here at home?
Peter Van Buren, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Peter Van Buren is the author of We Meant Well, how I helped lose the battle for the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. His case has been taken up by the Office of Special Counsel, an independent federal agency set up to help whistleblowers. While the State Department declined to comment on his specific situation, spokesman Mark Toner gave us this statement, quote, "The State Department values the opinions of its employees and encourages expression of differing viewpoints and is committed to fairness in the workplace." You can find the entire statement at our website, npr.org. Turning to another story we're following, this one in Italy, where earlier today a court effectively ended a corruption trial against former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Berlusconi could have faced jail time if he'd been convicted of the charges, in this case, bribery. But that's not the end of the road for the flamboyant former prime minister. He still faces charges that he paid an underage teenager for sex. His friends say that the man who once totally dominated Italian politics is now increasingly isolated, lonely, and some say depressed to be out of politics. Last month, the writer Philip Delves Broughton managed to spend the day with Berlusconi at his apartment in Rome. And he wrote about it in The Atlantic. When he got there, Broughton found the larger-than-life politician dressed in a tracksuit.
It's funny, when you see him on television, he always seems like one of these sort of small Napoleonic European leaders. And you meet him, he's sort of big in the shoulders, he has the makeup on, he was wearing like a dark blue cashmere jogging suit. And the first thing you notice is he's a very, very lively 76-year-old. He's sort of bouncing around, he's greeting everybody, he's telling jokes. And he's got a big smile on his face. He's not an old geezer, you know, who's sort of stuck in his ways, stuck in his house at the end of his career.
And yet there was something very Sunset Boulevard about your profile, almost like watching Gloria Swanson in that play. I mean, first thing, let's talk about the makeup. This is something you noticed right away. He wears a lot of makeup.
Yeah, he does all these things that lay himself open to ridicule. And it isn't particularly pretty. It's rather obvious. But as I said, his personality and his sort of exuberance makes up for it. You're going to meet this man, and all you've heard about him for the last few years is, you know, what a joke he is and how he's had these sort of orgies with young women and he's disgraced Italy. And then you meet this character, and yes, he has the makeup, yes, he has the stacked heels, yes, he has the terrible hair implants, which are this funny colour. But he sits down and he starts making you laugh. I've met many, many politicians in my career as a journalist and foreign correspondent, and the vast majority of them are these dreary, pompous, self-inflated characters. And he is anything but that when you meet him. And part of it is this sort of comedic element about him.
And yet you describe somebody who is actually quite lonely. I mean, somebody who can't talk to many of his friends because of all these pending lawsuits against him. He's worried that his phones are tapped and that anything he says will be used in court against him. I mean,
well, this is what everyone told me in advance. They said, you know, he's terribly lonely since he left office. And in 2008, his mother died, which is a huge event for anyone. But for an Italian man of a certain kind is a deep, deep trauma. He was very close to his mother. His sister died in 2009. In the same year, his wife left him, saying that she found his behavior, especially his, I think she used the word obsession with young women, sick and ill. And he was sort of abandoned. He told me he was very insistent on this all the way through because I brought this up. I said, everyone in Rome tells me that you're lonely and depressed and wandering around here like some mad old king. And he said, no, I have my children. My daughter calls me twice a day the way my mother used to. But yes, you're right. He told me he can't talk on the phone because of this fear, this paranoia, and it seems justified, given how much he's been tapped over the years and the terrible things that have come out. And I think many of his political allies have gone away. He's at the end of a rather glorious business career. He said he doesn't want to be prime minister anymore. You do wonder, yes, all these bunga-bunga parties, orgies, all these kinds of things that have been alleged. Many people around him told me, yes, they're a function of his loneliness.
He is still the de facto head of his political party, right? Which is still the largest political party in Italy.
In any normal democracy, he's prime minister. You know, he came to power in 1993 with enormous excitement around him. He was this incredibly successful entrepreneur. You know, he was the richest man in Italy. He owned the most successful soccer team. And when he came in 1993, it was this sense that here is the man Italy has been waiting for, the man who's going to shake Italy into the, you know, into the future, shed any kind of vestiges of its sort of communist socialist past, and really bring it into the modern era, sort of the way Margaret Thatcher did with Britain. And he never did it. And the question everyone keeps asking is why 18 years on, 19 years on, is he still in politics and he still hasn't done anything close to what people thought he would?
Who visits him?
Who goes to see him?
Yeah, I mean, does he have visitors every day?
Yes, I think he does. I think he, when I was there interviewing him, a Tunisian movie producer came in to see him and they were having dinner later. I think he is close to his family. One of his daughters runs Fininvest, which is his large business operation. He has a close relationship with Vladimir Putin, which again, a lot of people look at and think, you know, what's going on there? But again, I think he is a man who all his life has been a deeply, deeply social man. He thrives on contact with other human beings. And I think the way he's been cut off and isolated in the past few weeks and months, I think has been deeply wounding to him.
That's writer Philip Delves-Broughton. He wrote about his visit with former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi for The Atlantic. Philip, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And it's time now for music. This is the music of jazz pianist Robert Glasper. The thing you need to know about him is, firstly, he's a young man in a genre dominated by older ones. Glasper's 33. And the second thing, he's convinced jazz has hit a wall. It's too safe, even a bit boring. So Glasper's set out to change it. He takes soul, hip-hop, rock, classical, whatever feels interesting, and he throws it right into the mix.
Coming to your mind, live and direct from the ethers. Now it's all in your speakers, down to your sneakers.
His band is called the Robert Glasper Experiment, and this is off his new record. It's called Black Radio. The liner notes include what I guess you'd call a manifesto. It says in one place, the collective dumbing down of our music is the greatest tragedy we can impose on generations to follow. And for that, Robert Glasper blames the tastemakers who control pop radio.
They just play the same five horrible songs. You know, it's all about what's hot now. And what is hot now, especially when it comes to African-American music, they choose the dumbest stuff to play sometimes. It's just like, really, you're going to play that? The guys are talking about the same, and the women are talking about the same things that don't mean anything, you know, degrading each other. It's just bad, and the music's bad. But that sets the bar, because now everybody, since that gets a lot of radio play, everybody wants to get radio play. So now artists are coming out trying to do that exact same thing. And that's not cool, because we're going to lose a lot of great artists, because artists think you have to do this certain thing to be heard on the radio.
This is the question I have for you, Robert, because when you were a kid, pop music was Prince and Madonna and Michael Jackson and Whitney Houston, great, great artists. But I think one could argue that pop music today is pretty good. I mean, you've got some amazing singers, Adele, Rihanna, Nicki Minaj, you can go on and on. I mean, some would argue that there's actually a renaissance in pop music today.
There's a renaissance, but I wouldn't say everybody's really good. I would say the actual great singer is a lost art. There are very famous people. There are people who are characters and people who make it because they're different. But the actual art, like what their actual voice, like a great singer, there aren't as many great singers at that level as there used to be for me. You know, a lot of the people you name, like Nicki Minaj, is not a great singer.
She's a great artist in some ways.
She's an artist. And that's what I'm saying. You know, some people are artists, they're stylists, you know what I mean? Which is great as well. But I'm more speaking to the actual just art of singing. Mm. And I don't think that's the case nowadays, because nowadays it's not about how good you can sing. It's about really the song and how you look. So I'm trying to get away from that. That's why everybody on my album, they're known for being great singers as well as stylists at the same time. You know, they don't sound like anyone else. Like Layla Hathaway, everybody who sings, who knows her, is like, she is that person. I think every artist I have on there is a jazz musician at heart, even if they've never sung a jazz tune in their life. Everybody kind of has a jazz backbone or jazz spine, or you know what I mean? And it made it easy to make this record.
Ha, you're rocking. Yes, you are rocking with the fresh. You are rocking with the depth. You are rocking with the best.
fresh. You are rocking with the yes. Now you are rocking with the fresh. You're rocking with the depth. You are rocking with the fresh. The yes.
I'm speaking with jazz pianist and composer Robert Glasper. His new record is called Black Radio. Probably the two most purely American forms of music, one could argue, are jazz and hip-hop, right? Both created by Americans, both created by African-Americans.
Right.
And yet rarely have those two forms of music met, right?
Right.
But you do that on this record very deliberately.
Right.
And yet it's still considered unorthodox and even shunned by some of your fellow jazz artists. Why?
Because they can't do it and they're jealous. Well... it's funny because, like, put it like this, it's like a person just not knowing their dad. That's not how it's supposed to be.
Mm.
Jazz is the father of hip-hop.
Yeah.
Without jazz, there would be no hip-hop. Without jazz, there would not be a lot of music. But without jazz, there definitely wouldn't be any hip-hop. So they go hand in hand. It's really, the question is, why hasn't it been done as much?
But here's a thing that I don't get, right? I mean, the history of jazz is about rebels, about people who were experimenting in ways that were pushing the boundaries. Like Miles Davis was doing things that were so radical, and
exactly.
yet today, I mean, the mainstream jazz community still finds it odd to hear hip-hop and jazz together.
We kind of kill the alive to praise the dead. And I don't think that the jazz community embraces newer artists anymore. We get mad that new audiences don't want to come watch us play, you know, but it's like, you know, we keep sending our grandfather out to the playground.
Hmm. In other words, you keep playing standards. I mean, you're asked to play standards when
that kind of vibe and that kind of mindset. You know what I mean? Everybody else is sending their kids out to the playground. This thing, new sound, new vibrant life out into the world. And we keep sending our grandfather out and wondering why nobody wants to play with us. We have to embrace our new sounds because that's what it's always been doing. You know, that's why jazz kept changing. It always changed. You know what I mean? It's supposed to change. It's about being relevant and taking from my surroundings now. I know some jazz musicians are like, oh, you're selling out. But when you think about it, I'm not selling out. I'm doing what Train and Miles were doing. I'm doing what Herbie does. Herbie's still doing it. You know, that's not selling out. He's selling out venues. if that's what it means, then cool. If my thing is, if Train came back to life right now, you know, he'd be mad as hell if people were still doing the exact same thing he was doing when he died.
Well, Robert Glasper, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's pianist and jazz composer Robert Glasper. His new album with the Robert Glasper Experiment is called Black Radio. It's out on Tuesday, but right now you can listen to every track from the record for free at our website, nprmusic.org. Today, we're rolling out a new occasional series. It's called Why Music Matters. Every now and then, we'll bring you the stories of music fans in their own words about how a song or a band changed their lives. Today, how the Cranberries helped one young man come to terms with his identity.
A lot of things were the devil. They would say, "This isn't from the Lord." My name is Nathan Hotchkiss. I had a bit of a difficult upbringing. My parents were very religious. I was limited to listening only to Christian music and classical. My father would stay away a lot, and my mother would be wrapped up in all her own turmoil. And then it would spill over onto me. Around 13 years old is when I really started discovering music. I was down at my friend's house babysitting. I was flipping through her CDs and popping in various ones and happened upon the Cranberries. Do you like me? Do you like me standing there? I remember being overcome with just emotion. The emotion that was poured out by Dolores, that lead singer, just that touched me to hear that much passion come out of one body. And I really hadn't heard anything like that before. It was confusing to have been sheltered from that for so long and not understand why. Then I started collecting music and hiding it in various places in my house and listening to it late at night when my parents, I thought, were sleeping. I would put the cassette player right behind my head and play it at a soft level and just quietly sing along. There was a Cranberries cassette tape that I'd listen to, and there was one track always where the lead singer would make this sound like and it sounded like my mother when she yells. And I'd always freak out and turn off the cassette tape really quick and just expect to see my mother coming in through the door. "What are you doing?" "Be a good boy." My parents were always telling me what to do and how to be. "Try a little harder." When they'd go out and do something, I'd turn on these CDs and scream at the top of my lungs along with the music, and I was able to relate to someone else who I felt had gone through something like that. I knew I wasn't normal, and everything that my parents' church talked about said that I was an abomination. My preference seemed to always lean towards boys. As I got older, I, you know, realized that it was part of who I was. Everything I do for you. Many of the song's lyrics that I listened to would talk to me and tell me that I wasn't the only one out there going through feelings like this and being treated the way I was. Coming out, really, you know, put everything under the table. And my parents, through everything, we've managed to grow closer, and our relationship is the strongest now than it's ever been. Someone out there may hear this story and have had a similar situation or is still in it, and have faith that things will turn out for the better.
That's Nathan Hotchkiss on Why Music Matters. And Nathan Hotchkiss joins us now from KEXP in Seattle. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's a beautiful story. And Nathan, I want to bring in a special guest who's been listening to your story along with us, Dolores O'Riordan, the lead singer with the Cranberries. Dolores, say hello to Nathan.
Hey, Nathan, how are you? That's a totally lovely story.
Thank you so much for what you do. I appreciate you.
Oh, you know, I appreciate you. appreciating me, because you know what, it's lovely to hear stories like that, you know, to kind of think that your music touches people to that level. It's really great, you know, and you know, I think everybody in life, you know, we go through struggles, and the reason we go through those struggles is because later we become stronger people. And
I agree,
the journey of life is never perfect, but what's really sweet is how you've turned it around, and you know that you're saying you're closer to your parents now than ever before.
That's true. Thank you.
My dad just died there on the 25th of November. And the one thing was beautiful was that, you know, before they go, you make peace with them and you accept everything. And, you know, that way you feel great peace inside your own heart. So that's really cool that you found that inner peace too, you know.
I agree, definitely.
Nathan, I know we sprung this on you and you were not expecting Dolores O'Riordan in the studio with us.
No.
And what about now at this point in your life? Are you in a place where all of those things have kind of fallen into place and those struggles seem almost distant?
Yeah, that's the case, definitely. I recently got my mom to move out here to Seattle. She was in Massachusetts and had moved back there to reconcile her relationship with her daughters, and that didn't really pan out. So it was a 3-year-long campaign of bugging her to move out here, and now she's about 12 blocks away.
Yeah, it's great, you know. Well, life is all about healing, isn't it, and acceptance, and just to find your own peace in your own heart and to love yourself is the most important thing you could do.
Definitely, I agree wholeheartedly.
Well, Dolores, thank you so much for coming and doing
this. Yes, and thanks, Nathan. That was a really nice story, very inspiring, and look after yourself, and you're a great heart, you're a great person.
Thank you, and you are as well.
Good luck with everything.
Dolores O'Riordan is the lead singer with the Cranberries. They've got a new record out now. It's called Roses. And I'm sure Nathan Hotchkiss, if he doesn't have it yet, we will buy it very soon. Nathan Hotchkiss joined us from KEXP in Seattle. Nathan, thank you so much for your story.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Why Music Matters comes to us from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and KEXP-FM Seattle, produced by Anna Boyko-Wyrock, with support from the National Endowment for the Arts. For the week ending February 26, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Petra Mayer and Phil Harrell and edited by Mathoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, and Kenya Young. Lauren Benishu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.